Atari's home game division had pretty much lost a lot of their engineers and a lot of their throughput. And this was happening at the time that the games were booming. And so they needed more engineers to work on them and asked us. And we said, sure, we'll give it a try. And we became very, very skilled at creating the home versions of a lot of the arcade games that were being created by Atari and by many companies in Japan. Hi, I'm Doug McRae, co-founder of General Computer Corporation, and you are listening to the Ted Dabney Experience Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Richard May and I'm here as always with Retro Gamer Magazine's Paul Drury.
Hello.
And Missile Commander author Tony Temple.
Hi.
For any new listeners, it's worth restating our raison d'etre, which is that we talk at length with not only the leading lights, but also the supporting cast from the proverbial golden age of video arcade games, i.e. the early 70s to the mid 90s. I'd encourage you to make your way through our back catalogue, one episode of which, back in January of 2021, was with Steve Golson, co-creator of General Computer Corp's Super Missile Attack and Miss Pac-Man. If for no other reason, then it's a great companion piece to this episode, which is, of course, with GCC's co-founder, Doug McRae. As ever, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Gary Vincent. The Ted Dabney Experience podcast is brought to you in association with ACAM, the American Classic Arcade Museum. Visit ClassicArcadeMuseum.org to learn more about our collection and visit us in Laconia, New Hampshire.
Doug, welcome to the podcast. It's wonderful to have you on the show. And actually, we have had one of your previous GCC colleagues, Steve Golson, on the show before, and he was at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, with you. Now, he told us, Doug, that you were not the typical student. You were different from the others because you had a car and a girlfriend. So come on, Doug, you can tell us, were you the big man on campus?
Well, having a car definitely made you a big man on campus. It was a old 73 Toyota with 140,000 miles on it, but we had many car mechanics that could help keep it running.
Okay. I hear that not only did you have those two cool things, a car and a girlfriend, you also had a pinball table. So perhaps you could explain what a first year, I think, student was doing with a pinball table.
It was actually my second year that my older brother had bought the pinball machine to run at his fraternity at his college. And when he graduated, he passed it on to me and I set it up in our dorm and started collecting quarters.
Okay. So perhaps you should take a step back. What was your brother doing with a pinball table?
That's the better question. I don't think he had any idea.
Right.
He came home one vacation and suggested to my dad that this was a great business investment. And my older brother is very different from He is a lawyer and has no mechanical ability whatsoever. And he convinced my dad to go in on buying a Gottlieb Pioneer pinball machine and that he would take perfectly good care of it. And it turned out to be the only pinball machine in history I know of that never broke down at all. So he would bring it home over Christmas vacation and over the summer vacation, and I would kind of overhaul it, but it would go months without having any mechanical problems, and I don't know how it happened.
So the fact is that you were tinkering with it even before it became yours to run. So is, maybe this is a good lead-in, is that what you were studying at MIT, engineering?
Yes, I was a mechanical engineer, architecture, and economics major.
Now, I'm quite interested in the economics, bit there, because you've got the technical ability, but you've also got this maybe a business brain. So could you see that running a pinball table on campus, you could make some money out of this?
I don't think I need the economics degree for that. We ended up with big bags of quarters being emptied a couple of times right. a week, and that became quite obvious. But we did have some interesting, maybe economic maneuvers that mm-hmm. we were known on campus for giving out 5 quarters for $1 that we knew they would all come back to us. And we looked and said it was easier carrying paper money around than having to carry all these quarters. So we were happy to give 5 quarters for $1 and they would all come back.
So that's brilliant. So hang on. You also just then used the word we. So you own this pinball table, but are you implying that soon it became more of a maybe a collective endeavor?
Yeah, so I got the first machine from my brother, and it was doing very, very well. Bought a second machine, and it was more of an electromechanical, and right. I decided to take on an electrical engineer as a partner, Kevin Curran, and the two of us started repairing them and handling the quarters and whatever. And the business grew from there.
Wow. Tell us a bit about Kevin, because obviously he's going to be a big part of the GCC story. So were you classmates? How did you come to meet him?
So we were classmates, and in the dorm, we were living about 5 doors apart from each other. And so I knew him pretty well, and he had very great skills in electrical engineering. And so the two of us hit it off well. I was the mechanical engineer. He was the electrical engineer. And together we could repair any pinball machine.
Fantastic. I just want to talk a little bit more about pinball. Can you just explain to us how this works? So, obviously we're English. So did you just take this pinball table and sort of put it in a communal area where students live? Perhaps you could give us a feel of, I'm sure our American listeners will be going, it's obvious, but it certainly isn't to me.
It actually is not quite that obvious.
Good.
Dormitory that we lived in had about 300 people in it, but it was broken down into entryways with each about 50. So we put the pinball machine in our entryway with about 50 people, though other people could get access to it. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was a recreation room in the entire dorm that 300 people could get to. And there were a couple of old pinball machines in that operated by another operator. Eventually that operator pulled out. And so we moved our machines there and then started expanding.
That's interesting. So there was someone who, I presume, a professional businessman that was running an arcade route on campus. But you as students just kind of stepped up and went, we'll take this on. Did you need to convince anyone? Did you have to get permission from the university?
Well, when we moved into the dormitory rec room, yes, we did have to get approval from the dormitory's government. I happen to be vice president of that, so that helps some.
this is not insider dealing there, is it?
No. but more importantly, we offered to split the revenue of the pinball machines 50-50 with the house. And then the house would use their revenue to fund the parties. So it was a very
mutually beneficial,
yes, operation that we pull in a lot of quarters, and it would create good parties for the dormitory.
And did you make that clear to your customers, your fellow students, that hey, half of what you put in here, you'll be drinking that at a party?
I think they all knew it.
Brilliant. We've talked a bit about pinball there. Of course, our podcast is focused on video games. And just before I start asking you about how you got into video games, is that MIT is usually seen as the home of video games, or in that it's where Space War back in the early 60s, 62, 63, Steve Russell and his fellow students created the first video game, Space War. Were you aware of that at all? Because you'd be there in, you better tell us, what year were we talking about when you started at MIT?
Started in 1977. Okay. So I was not aware at the time.
Really?
But any kind of gaming with computers were very much part of our life. So we were on computers playing games like Adventure and Zork and other things, but was not aware of the original video that happened back then.
Okay. So you're at MIT. You've got some pinball tables. This is like the late 70s, maybe 79. At what point do you say we ought to buy a video game?
Well, video games were just starting to really hit their stride then. There was some before that, but, we started looking and saying they were pulling in money faster than the pinball machines. Mm. And so after looking at several arcades and whatever, we decided to start buying some video games, and they all did quite well, particularly a individual game made by Atari called Missile Command.
Ah, we will come to Missile Command. But just before that, I wondered, because this will be sort of maybe 79, 80 maybe, when you're getting into video games. So what did you buy? I'm thinking Space Invaders, Asteroids. Did you buy, were those your first purchases?
I think the first ones was a copy of maybe Battlezone, a sub game called Sub-Zero. That's a refrigerator. It was.
It could be called Subs. There was a game called Subs, was it that?
I don't recall the name of the sub game. I may come up with it later. A game called Rip Off. We got Star Castle.
Yeah. That's interesting that you've got quite, both of those are Tim Skelly games, and they're both vector games. Vector games, the technology in that can be fragile. Was this a new challenge for you and your partner, Kevin, to keep these machines running?
Not at the time. They all performed quite well on their own. And maybe Kevin was doing some stuff behind the scenes, but they kept working.
Excellent. Tell us how the business grew. I mean, as the dawn of the 80s, I mean, how many machines are you running across campus?
Well, within about a year, we had expanded to 20 machines. In a couple of different dormitories. And this was enough to pay our tuitions. We did not literally pay them in quarters. We took the quarters down to the bank, put the, deposited them, and then wrote checks to the, institute. But, at the time we thought the tuition was outrageously high, and yet we could afford it with the amount of quarters we were earning.
I would have loved if you just turned up with a bag of quarters and sort of poured it dramatically over the dean's desk, but not to me. Can you give us a vague idea how much you were how much were you taking in perhaps per month, maybe? I don't know.
Well, tuition, at the time, I remember that was $5,300. It's more than 10 times that now. Yeah. So we were pulling in more than $10,000 a year.
And this is in 1980?
Correct.
This is, can I ask, I am in education, so I am very concerned. Were you able to keep up your studies, seeing as you're running what sounds like a rather lucrative business?
Yes, the only thing that suffers is sleep. Yes, I had this business going. We had other jobs, and I was also playing, we call it soccer, but you guys call it football.
Yeah, because that's the right name for it, Doug. You've corrupted that, but we'll forgive you.
You're going to claim you kick it with your foot and not, never mind.
Yes, okay. I see. So you were keeping up, your studies and your extracurricular activities.
Yes.
Okay. We mentioned Kevin Curran. We also earlier mentioned Steve Golson, who's been on the show. Did you meet him at this time as well?
Yeah, he lived right across the hall. So we had quite a few people all within several doors that became involved in our company eventually. Steve was the very next one to join.
Wow. I suppose you've got a pool of talented, interested people who don't need much sleep either.
That is totally true. We got a lot of our good work done at 2 a.m.
I'm sure you did. Now, just bring us on to the next part of the story. Things were going well, and particularly this game, Missile Command. I just wondered, why do you think that was the one that you kind of picked out as, you know, it did really well amongst students?
Well, Missile Command, if you're familiar with it, is a game where you try preventing cities from being destroyed by intercontinental ballistic missiles. And that kind of hit the heart of what a lot of MIT students were thinking or maybe even working on in their summer jobs. A lot worked for Department of Defense, were very familiar with incoming ICBMs. Mm-hmm. And it was a interesting kind of strategy, kind of coordination game. And so it hit really well for the MIT campus.
Hello, Doug.
Hello, Tony.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. So my understanding is you were operating three Missile Command cabinets at MIT. And presumably at some point you started to notice that these video games had a shelf life.
Yeah, so we bought our first Missile Command game. It probably cost $2,500. And in the first week of operating it, it pulled in roughly $600, which doing the math is 2,400 quarters, meaning it is being played for about 3 minutes per quarter and 18 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
And so people were playing till 4 a.m, getting up at 7 a.m. to play, and it was being played nonstop. That was the good news. The next week, revenue fell by 30-40%, dropping to about $400 because the average play length had gone longer. People were now playing for 4 to 5 minutes. Tony, you're probably playing for 10 minutes at this time. And people were also not quite as excited to play. So our 4 a.m. traffic probably had fallen a good bit. Right. And this trend continued, as it does for any video game. But the Missile Command one fell off quite quickly because people got very good at it. And so a game could last 20 minutes, and therefore you're only getting less than $1 per hour.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this must have been quite a shock. I mean, for all intents and purposes, you were an operator. And so I mean, was there a sense of kind of panic about ultimately losing money, and or were you starting to think about what can we do about this?
Well, we went to one of the local arcades, and we knew the owner there and started talking with him. Mm. And he said that for many of his games, he started buying speed-up kits. And the big one at the time, the big speed-up kit, was Asteroids. And all it did is, I believe, change the clock frequency right. that the processor was running off of. And it ran it faster. And it usually worked fine. Every now and then people would put in too fast a clock and it would occasionally have glitches. But, if you sped it up by 50% or 100%, the game would run faster and people would lose faster and you'd bring in more quarters, except for the fact that a lot of people looked and said, that's not fair. All you've really done is sped it up. And so it kind of caused people to lose interest also. But we talked to him about that. He goes, you should still consider it. And we go, well, the problem is we've got a game called Missile Command. We got three of them. Are there any speed up kits for those anyway? And he said, no, unfortunately not. From what I hear on the street, no one's been able to create a speed up kit for it because it's a more complicated processor and there's too many interdependencies on the timing that if you try speeding up the clock, it just fails.
Sure. And at that point, did you think we can fix this for our machines? Or was there a bit of a light bulb moment thinking there's a bigger opportunity here?
Yeah, you know, I think as we were talking to the operator, he may have even suggested, you guys go to MIT, why don't you design a kit right. to make this better?
Okay. And so this was March 1981, if my timeline's correct. So what did you do? I mean, presumably you then went to sort of round up the great and the good of the people you needed in order to start working on this kit.
Yeah. So we kicked it around for a little while trying to understand what would be necessary. And several of us thought that what we could do is reprogram the game to make it better and faster and a little bit more challenging. So we thought about how we'd have to do that, and tried addressing it from a couple of different angles. One is feasibility. How would we go about doing this? And then the second was, how would we do it legally? Because right. we had an understanding that we couldn't just go and copy the ROMs and make modifications to them. That would be issues with copyright infringement. So mm-hmm. we wanted to figure out a way where we would not have those issues. I had taken a intellectual property class at MIT, and I was understanding the copyright issues. Later on, I found out there are trademark and misrepresentation of origin issues and other things. But at the time, we went out of our way to make sure we respected the copyright that Atari had.
So the actual development process, from what I've read, sounded pretty cumbersome. Can you talk us through the equipment you used and what you did to decode the code? Yeah.
So the first thing we concluded we had to do was really create the source code for the game. If you were to just dump out the ROMs, all you would get would be object code or machine code. And we would have to reverse assemble that and understand what all the code did. And to do that, it was really necessary to get what's called an in-circuit emulator, where you pull the processor out and you put the emulator in and allow the computer to take the place of the processor and be able to step through and modify the code.
Okay.
This emulator was quite new technology and very, very expensive. At the time, it cost $25,000, which in today's cost is almost $250,000. A very big investment to do, but we thought that this would be the only real way to do a good job on the development.
Interesting. And was it kind of like a process of elimination? So removing a small piece of code you could see what effect that had to the game as it was playing?
Yes. So we could read the code, and we started annotating it. But what we were not that clear of is what hardware registers did what and whatever, because we did not have true schematics of how the game worked or anything. So we had to poke some registers and see what they did and change some values and watch what happened and replace a subroutine and observe what that did. And so eventually we worked our way through it, where we had a very good understanding of how the missile command game worked, and then started asking ourselves, all right, if we were to make modifications, what would we change in it that could make it more challenging and more interesting?
Sure. And was that a process done on the fly, or did you have a kind of spec of what you wanted to add to Missile Command before you started the process?
I think a spec may sound more planned out and figured out than we actually were at the time. We had several ideas of things we wanted to try, but it was trial and error. We put several things in. They did not work well. We tried other things. If you're familiar with Super Missile Attack, we added a UFO to the sky that would zoom across, stop, and then charge up a laser beam. Mm-hmm. Well, that came out of an error that we had when we tried changing the missile speed of the incoming missiles, that it would go through things because of the collision detect wouldn't really run fast enough. So when we did that, it became more like a laser beam because it would actually go through clouds sometimes if they were small. So we go, oh, sounds like a UFO. So we built a UFO and shot laser beams down.
Sure.
Not part of the initial plan.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Super Missile Attack is, I think it's a fascinating piece of arcade history. And what I noticed about the game is when you got reasonably good at it, you realized that to continue playing the game as you would using the same mechanics in play on Missile Command would be a disaster. So when you hit a certain score and a certain speed, it actually becomes about scoring enough points to earn your next bonus city rather than actually defending the cities you have. So you could almost ignore the core game mechanic of Missile Command, which is you've got to protect these cities. And actually all you're trying to do is to get your score over the next bonus city kind of marker, whether that's 8,000 points or 10,000 points. So it actually completely changed the whole mechanic of Missile Command once you got good at it.
Yeah, and you did play with a totally different strategy. Missile Command, you're often laying down two blankets of clouds at the beginning mm-hmm. of each round. And as the game got more complex in Super Missile Attack, that was not that great a strategy anymore. So you're now starting to try getting individual shots onto the UFO, and it changed it a good bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the game is done, Doug. And at this point, you guys are no longer on campus. You're living off campus, and the game's ready. How did you go about actually building the kits?
So what was very important to us, as I mentioned before, was not violating the copyright of Atari. So we wanted to do some circuitry that we were not reproducing any of Atari's code. And so the way it worked was we had a board that would seed into the Atari board and would overlay our code on top of the Atari code. And what was also critical about that was if we had just modified the ROMs, besides having the copyright issue, any operator of video games could just duplicate those ROMs and make as many copies of ours as he wanted to. Mm-hmm. So what Kevin and Steve Golson did was they designed a really fascinating circuit, which later they patented, that took our code and overlaid it on top of the code of Atari. And so it would watch the address lines, and when it got to certain set points, it would jump from the Atari code to our code, run that for a little while, and then jump back to the Atari code. And this prevented people from easily copying our code, and it also solved the biggest part of the copyright issue.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned copyright issues, and obviously we'll come on to digging into that a little bit further. But you guys, formed this company, General Computer Corporation, which is a very grand name for, an almost sort of hobbyist business, running out of digs, on the outskirts of Boston. And you guys placed full page color advertisement in, trade magazine. So, you were certainly going big, and one would assume that operators seeing that advertisement probably had a fair bit of confidence that this was a credible company and this was a great product.
Yeah. So what we really feared was getting mixed in with the crowd. There were all these speed up kits, and they were taking out tiny ads in the back of the magazines and whatever. And we decided that we wanted to be much more on par with the game manufacturers than these kind of gray area speed up kits, which we're not sure whether even legal. They sometimes work, sometimes did not work. So our strategy was that we were going to sound big. We chose the name General Computer Corporation to sound big. We got an 800 number for people to call in their orders with. And then we did full page color ads to kick off our product launch.
Amazing. Can you give us some numbers, Doug?
Sure.
How much did the kits cost to make? How much did you sell them for, and how many did you sell?
So the kits cost $20 to $30 a piece to make. They're relatively simple boards that involved no labor costs because we're all students. So people were doing the soldering down in the basement and doing the assembly and putting them in boxes and whatever. So there was some more cost than that, but the material cost was in the 20s, and we were selling them in the back of the magazine for $295. So the profit on each was $260,
$270. Holy smokes.
Which was very, very nice.
Yeah, no kidding.
And, in a very short period of time, several months, we sold a little over 1,000 of them. So, in our senior year of college, we had pulled in a profit of $250,000.
That's incredible. Amazing. Well, of course, not only did the operators, get wind of the kit, but a certain manufacturer of arcade machines, Atari, also got wind of what you guys were up to. I wonder at this point we should probably address what you were doing could have meant for Atari. So obviously their whole business model was built around obsolescence. So a game became less popular over time, as you guys saw with your three Missile Command cabinets. And Atari's intention was to sell operators a new game to replace the obsolete games. Now, your kit would, in theory, extend the life of a game like Missile Command, and presumably, ultimately, that would have resulted in less sales for Atari. Do you think this is why they eventually got wind of what you were doing and decided to take legal action? Rather than just, here's some guys who are pirates and we need to shut them down.
Yeah, no, I think it was quite a simple decision on their part that even if we extended the life of the game only 20%, it meant that they lost 20% of their revenue. And my guess is it was probably more like 30 or 40%. So we were becoming a big issue for them about whether this would continue to erode their marketplace. Up to now, all they saw were these small companies selling speed up kits, which did not do all that much in extending the life because they were not that much fun to play. And now we had come along and it wasn't quite version 2 of the game, but it was version 1.5. People were enjoying it, playing it longer, and therefore the operators were no longer necessarily buying a replacement right away.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And were you guys not terrified when the lawsuit came in? I mean, we're kind of talking about a David and Goliath moment here.
We were probably too young and naive to realize that we should be a little more terrified. I remember when we first got sued, Atari filed a suit against me for $5 million, Kevin for $5 million, and General Computer for $5 million. I think they wanted to go after each of us to make sure we were really scared. My dad saw the story coming across the Business Wire of the United States and called me up and said, Doug, I just got two questions for you. Are you going to win this? And if you don't, do you have $5 million? I said, yes and no.
Wow. That's amazing confidence to go in there. But presumably you genuinely felt you had a case to put to the court, aside from your relative naivety. I mean, were you happy with the way the case was initially going?
Well, it was more complex than we had given it credit for. That back then, copyright law on or intellectual property law, as it applied to many things, particularly video games and audiovisual displays, was still in its infancy. No one really knew how to protect it. People were filing copyrights on the source code of computer programs and were being told you could not copyright the object code. Okay. And then it was being brought up, but what about the audiovisual presentation it creates? And Atari, which was really the leader back then in the intellectual property and protecting it, was part of Warner Communications. And their legal staff looked at it and said, we need to define a part of intellectual property law that can protect the audiovisual presentation so that it's not just the object code. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at some of the old games, I think Missile Command was one of these, you will see a C circle, which in the United States means copyright, and you will see a P and a circle.
That's right. Yes.
And Atari created this. It doesn't exist in American law. It was phonographic copyright, and they said this applies to the audiovisual presentation. Mm. And they kind of invented that and said that we own the image that's being put out. And there's some valid arguments for saying it has to extend across that. You know, if you go to movies, if you go to eventually video games and other graphical displays, you have to look at the results it's creating. And mm-hmm. so they were taking the stand that they own the audiovisual presentation and that anybody walking up to it would recognize that this was Atari's property, not just to someone that looked at the object code.
Yeah, for sure. And interestingly, there's a newspaper cutting, and I can't remember which newspaper printed it, but there's a photograph of you standing in front of a Missile Command cabinet, which has bespoke Super Missile Attack artwork applied to it. Presumably that was done in response to that particular point you've just made, which is Atari's argument was, well, you know, when somebody rocks up to this Missile Command, in inverted commas, cabinet, they're expecting to play an Atari game, but they're not playing an Atari game. They're playing a GCC game.
Right. So what happened in the lawsuit, we end up in federal district court, which is the really highest level until you get to our Supreme Court, you know, leaving out the appellate courts in the United States. So this was very high level. Atari wanted to probably scare us as best that they possibly could. So they filed in federal court. And I think all the way along expected us to just fold. There's a whole bunch of small details. We actually filed first to get the venue in the on the East Coast rather than the West Coast. So we sued Atari before they sued us. But the whole claim that Atari was making was quite grandiose. They were saying copyright infringement, which we felt very, very good on. But then they brought out two other charges. One was misrepresentation of origin, which, as you said before, if someone is walking up to the game, do they think that they're getting an Atari product or do they think they're getting someone else's product? Mm. And if you walked up to a Super Missile Attack, you might think you're getting an Atari product, and they claim that that misrepresented to the customer who the manufacturer was. And this was relatively new law also. And then the third thing they claimed is trademark dilution, which a lot of intellectual properties was exploring at the time of saying, all right, can you dilute someone else's trademark? Can you take advantage of it? And in some ways, we were taking advantage of the Missile Command trademark when we used a whole bunch of their things, like their fonts and everything else, that people were very familiar with their trademark, and we were piggybacking on top of it. So as we went through the court and it was becoming unclear on how this would be decided, our lawyer said, well, Your Honor, what would happen if we solved all their issues for that they have brought up in court, this misrepresentation of origin and whatever? And the judge said, well, then I would take a look at that. And he goes, well, Monday morning, I'll bring in a new one. And we're looking at him going, how do we create a new one by Monday morning? He goes, you guys are MIT. You guys don't sleep. Figure it out. And so we started making one where we changed the fonts, we changed the colors, and the one in the newspaper you saw, we changed this decals on the side and on the front panel and everything, making it extremely different. Not necessarily in a good way, but to test out the legal principles that Atari was standing by. And the importance of that was it then let Atari really know that eventually we could string them further and further out onto, bring them further out onto the branch, of saying, all right, where do you eventually lose your intellectual property rights to this? And that if we won in court, it would potentially open up the path for everybody to start doing enhancement kits.
Right.
So Atari looked at it and said, all right, we may win round one, but eventually we'll lose to these guys. It might be round two, might be round three, and they will define the path other people will use. So instead they decided to come talk to us.
Yeah. And talk to you they did. Skip Paul, I think, was Atari's lawyer. And they ultimately chose to settle with you. How much of that do you think was born out of frustration? So presumably they had guys jumping on planes, flying to the East Coast to appear in court to testify, and you guys were digging your heels in, and you were, you know, presumably, you know, starting to sort of ride the wave to a certain extent, and maybe they sort of sensed that.
Well, I think a little bit of it was frustration that part of our lawyer's plan was to be irritating, and he was. That when you get into a case like this, you can go and depose their president, and they can be having to fly to the East Coast and, you know, testify in court. And so, you know, we were an irritant that way. But yep. I think what was really behind, you know, our eventual settlement there and how to solve things was the danger that we would create the path that other people could follow. And they did not want that to ever happen.
Right. And so they made you an offer that you couldn't refuse.
Doug. Well, we actually did slightly refuse it, but I'll get into that in a second. Their offer was that we could do that. Well, backing up a minute, they asked us what we wanted, and we said we love developing video games, and we just did not have at the time the ability to build our own because you had to build these cabinets and electronics and whatever. So we, as a first step, created the enhancement kit. And they said, well, how about if we had you develop video games for us? We said, well, you're number one in the industry. We would love to develop for you. And so the eventual solution was they offered us a contract to develop video games for 2 years for them and were paying us $50,000 a month or $1.2 million to go develop video games for Atari. And in the contract, it said how their right of first refusal worked and how much we'd get paid in royalties and whatever. None of which they cared about. All they wanted to do was to pay us $1.2 million to solve things in court and to have us go away.
Right.
Years later, I was having drinks with Skip, Paul, and we were kind of laughing, and he goes, what was the strangest thing is I had told everybody in management I just paid these guys $1.2 million to go sit on the beach. And we laughed and said, oh, we actually thought we had an obligation to deliver video games to you. So we started hiring engineers. And he goes, well, that was a great thing because we later needed those video games, but that was not our intention.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just a side note, and one thing I've never been able to establish, that what actually happened to Super Missile Attack? I mean, why was there not talk of that being formally released by Atari as an add-on kit or a Missile Command 2?
Well, you have to understand, Atari did not want enhancement kits, so there was no way they were going to sell it or allow us to sell it. Mm-hmm. But when you said they made us an offer we couldn't refuse, we did have one issue with the offer they were making. It was $1.2 million, but we were developing our next enhancement kit in parallel with being in court. We did not like sleeping, so we had to get moving on to the next game. And so we were doing an enhancement kit to Pac-Man, and if necessary, we would throw that enhancement kit in the trash. But we were most of the way done with it and wanted a shot at potentially selling that kit.
Okay.
Atari is looking to go, no way. The reason we're, you know, moving forward with the settlement is we don't want enhancement kits. Nobody wants enhancement kits. And we said, well, what if we had the manufacturer's approval And so the eventual contract with Atari said we would never do an enhancement kit again without the approval from the manufacturer of that game. And Atari said, you'll never get that, so we're not worried.
Doug, we're aptly, appropriately coming on to one of the coin-op games you're most famous for, which is, of course, Miss Pac-Man, or Miss Pac-Man. And even before the Super Missile Attack court case was over, as you've just been talking to Tony about, you were already thinking about what game or games you might produce an enhancement kit for next. So you've kind of you've preempted my first question on my notes there. But why did you settle on Pac-Man, Doug? What was it about the game that made you think a kit would be in demand? It might be obvious to us all at this remove with regard to what made Pac-Man so great, but at the time, what attracted you guys to it?
Yeah, it was obvious. We did do a little bit of discussion, kicking around which game we should look at next, but yeah, it was obvious. Pac-Man was the big seller at the time. It was everywhere. And then Pac-Man had an even bigger flaw than Missile Command did in terms of people being able to play forever and people yes. getting bored of the game. And so right. it fit the enhancement kit very well. And yep. it was a huge success in a game out there in the marketplace, much bigger than even Missile Command.
Yeah, sure. So how did you go about addressing this problem that you identified, with the original Pac-Man? How walk us through, for the benefit of our maybe less technically minded listeners, what that might look like for you at the time.
Well, there are several things we wanted to really address with Pac-Man. One is it had a single maze, and I think people could
sure.
Go to sleep at night and see the maze in their dreams. They knew exactly what that maze was. And they were bored of the maze. They knew their way around the maze very well. And so it wasn't very creative, but we created four mazes for the enhancement kit. We spent a lot of time actually kind of test driving the mazes to make sure they work really, really well. There are not, unfair corners you got stuck in. There was not, really weird sections and whatever. So we created four great mazes with a lot of testing. But the biggest thing that made the difference was Pac-Man had an issue in terms of it was very predictable, or it was predictable. If you did the exact same thing from the start, the game would do the exact same thing. So you could learn a pattern. And pattern play was big back then. Everybody knew how to do the pattern to beat Pac-Man, or at least to play 80 rounds. So a person could drop in a quarter and play for 2 hours and just do the exact same thing. They were not really having fun, but they were setting a high score. But no quarters were going in. No one else could play the game. And then once they set a good high score, they kind of didn't play much anymore unless they got to a different machine where they could set the high score on. But sure. the game was having that issue. So we wanted to make sure that pattern play disappeared. The new mazes helped with that, so you would have to learn several. But more than anything, we wanted to
the ghosts
have the monsters, and I'll get into why I corrected you in a second.
Sure.
But we wanted to get the monsters to have a different intelligence. Intelligence is a totally misused word these days with artificial intelligence and whatever. These were very, very simple monsters, but we made them a little bit better that they did not always do the exact same thing at the exact same time. And hence, you could not memorize how to beat them.
So was this indeed a rudimentary AI then, Doug, would you say?
Having gone to MIT, we have definitions of AI, and no, this was not AI. This was just slightly smarter algorithms. It was not learning from you or anything else, but they were slightly smarter, and that made all the difference.
Okay, fine. So a world away from very obviously large language learning module software. So you're working on the movement and the predictability or unpredictability, of course, of the ghosts.
Monsters.
Can you monsters? Okay, you're definitely going to get to that, I can sense. So can you explain how, and I will have no idea what you're about to tell me, can you explain how you altered the code then? Let's get technical to make those ghosts less predictable.
So we were doing it with the exact same style we did on Missile Command. We're going to overlay software on it. And Mike Horowitz, a friend of mine that I recruited to come join us, looked at the code. And as I said, they were predictable, that when you started a game, it started a counter and, just a clock, incrementing 60ths of a second, or so, I forget what resolution it had. And so if you did the exact same turn as your first turn, it would happen at the exact same time, and the monsters would all look at this clock and base what they were going to do off of that. The first change was to say, don't base it just on that clock. Create a number that is more random. Computer engineers get in arguments about what really is a random number, but to get it so it's not always the same and not observable by the end user. And then these numbers are used to help determine when a monster will change its algorithm to chase you or to run into a corner or to do other things. And the changing of the timing made sure that it was not predictable anymore in what it would be doing.
Fine. Followed that extremely closely and understood every last word of it. But Doug, why monsters? What have you got against ghosts? I want to know.
So ghosts was an Atari invention. Back in when Pac-Man originally came out, they were being called monsters, and I don't recall what they were called in Japan. But when the original 2600 home version came out for the Atari home system, the four monsters shared a sprite or a stamp, and were only on 25% of the time because right. They shared one. And therefore, they flickered. They're on 25% of the time, off 75% of the time. And Atari marketing said, well, let's explain this away. Let's say they're ghosts, and they should be somewhat transparent. So Atari invented the term ghosts for the monsters. And ever since the 2600 cartridge came out, they're known as ghosts.
I personally think that's genius.
Yeah,
now you've told me. I had no idea that is genius. It's amazing, isn't it? The mother is the, I'm going to mangle that phrase. Doug, just going back to the testing, was all that testing in-house, so to speak, with you guys, or did you somehow manage to get any, did you manage to sneak aboard into any arcade and just kind of leave it there and observe, or was it all in-house?
No, we would put games out on test. We had a couple of arcades we worked with.
Yeah.
We did the Super Missile Attack out on tests, and it was always very helpful to make a few changes by, you know, going in and observing regular players, not just us, playing the game, seeing how they got good, what they liked. Mm. We would sometimes interview them afterwards, but we would watch them and see how it worked. And then we would also monitor the quarter count and the game length and things like that to see were we accomplishing what we wanted. Because as you tweaked a couple of variables, it would change the quarter counts, and it mattered a lot. So the Crazy Auto game, which was what we were calling the enhancement kit.
We'll come to that, but go on. The name. That is, but go on. Sorry,
we had put out on test first at a arcade in Framingham, Massachusetts, which was called 1001 Games or Fun and Games. And it was doing extremely well there. We were still tweaking a few things, but it was very successful. And we were excited about how it might do as an enhancement kit should we be allowed to sell it.
Were you occasionally perhaps surprised by things that players glommed onto that you perhaps didn't anticipate? Were there any kind of like second, third, fourth order, you know, kind of accidental consequences and weird things that you observed players doing in the wild, so to speak?
Yeah, well, finding out which features worked and which ones did not were always fascinating. We started moving the fruit around very early on, and the users really liked that. And they would often get killed going for the fruit, where the fruit did not give you that many points, particularly in the early rounds, but they had to have them. And it really, really created another distraction, which probably helped make the game shorter. But they would go for them. And then in later rounds, they had enough reward in terms of points that they were worth going for. But we also tried other things. We had at one point, occasionally a monster would greatly slow down and then would go through a wall. And, this was not taken well at all. You know, people would just go, "That's not fair." And you go, "Well, they're maybe they're ghosts and they can go through walls." No, I don't know. it was one of these things that, even if we slowed them down and slowed down how slowly they would go through walls, people still felt that's not fair. We're in a maze. They're not allowed to go through walls because I can't go through a wall. And so that got yanked out. You really do have to hear the customer's feedback, because we'll come at it from one direction, but they'll come at it from another.
Yeah, sure. And, whatever ideas did you have at the time, Doug, that perhaps did not make it through to the final version? And indeed, were any of those ideas implemented in test versions of the game? Are there any kind of secret half finished boards out there that we might not know about, that might sort of change the history of Pac-Man at this point?
I'm not remembering others besides the ghost going through the walls. I know Steve Golson has maintained kind of a collection of old ROMs of the game and goes through some of the ones we developed over time. So we had the initial one and then had many of the different characters we developed. But I'm not even sure he has one where you can go through the walls and whatever saved. So a lot of the things we tried probably are long gone, and rightfully so.
At what point did you, Doug, did you approach Bally Midway and say you were, let's say, "Guys, we're modding your game"? Well, Namco's game, obviously, but, you know, obviously Bally had the US license. At which point did you approach Bally and go, "This is happening"?
I think the day after we signed the Atari contract that gave us the right to sell it, if we had the manufacturer's approval, Kevin picked up the phone and called the president of Bally Midway and said, "I'd like to meet with you." And of course he goes, "Who are you?" "General Computer."
Yeah.
Probably sounded big. "Well, who's General Computer?" "Oh, yes, we were the ones in court with Atari." "Oh, he knew of that." And we go, "We'd like to come out and talk and to show you something." And so Kevin and maybe I don't recall, flew out, to Chicago and met with, Midway and showed them what was at the time an enhancement kit to Pac-Man called Crazy Auto. And it was slated to be sold by us at $295, just like, Super Missile Attack. But we had to get their permission. They did not know that, but that's what we were out there trying to do. And so we, because the whole Atari contract was confidential, told them that we had beat Atari in court and that we were going to go into production with or without their blessing, but it would be better to get their blessing so we would not have to sue them in court for declaratory judgment. We thought we were amazing poker players. I'm not sure our stance made any difference whatsoever, because reflecting back on it several months later, we found out that we were showing up the day, or maybe just the week, that they were shutting down the Pac-Man production line and laying off right. assembly workers because they right. had no follow on. Bally Midway did not produce a sequel at the time to Pac-Man. Namco did not produce a sequel, and they had no other great games in the pipeline to come out with. And we walk in the door, and I think their VP of marketing looks and goes, sequel, or at least said that to their president. And so they're looking at it and going, you just saved the day. We're looking at it thinking we're playing poker. And very, very quickly, we're shaking our hands on a deal of putting this into full arcade production and not being sold as an enhancement kit.
You've just reminded me, I don't know if you watched Seinfeld or did watch Seinfeld, you've reminded me of the episode where George decides that he's going to do the very opposite of everything he's done up until that day. And he goes for a job interview and arrogantly chastises the manager, the unseen off-screen manager of the baseball team. And insults him greatly, and the manager goes, "You're hired. Hire this guy." Reminds me of that.
Absolutely. No, it was fascinating looking back on it. We thought we were amazing and did not know until months later that, if we had just walked in and said, "We're desperate. Would you take this, and give us money for it?" They would have said yes.
They would have said yes. That's classic. Okay. Go on then, Doug. Crazy Otto. I mean, I've kind of forgotten the details, but we have discussed this before on the podcast. So we kind of know, and probably a lot of our listeners know if they want to get into the minutiae why the game is called Crazy Otto. But let's tell everybody again, where does that name come from?
I have no idea. If it does say in the podcast, I'd love to hear.
We don't know. That's why we're asking him the question.
Don't we?
We know that that's what it was called, and I understand, Doug, you call it that because you wanted to get it as far away from Pac-Man as possible, because you thought, one of the things that Atari had on us, that we were representing their visual imagery. So we'll make it look really different. We'll give him legs. We'll change.
Hang on. Wasn't this named after a manager of some?
No, that's Evil Otto in Berserk.
I'm going to listen to our own podcast. Yeah.
Well done.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'm leaving this all in.
Have you got any inkling? Because it is an odd name, Crazy Otto.
I'm really disappointed. I thought I was about to hear where the name came from, because I have searched and searched and asked around and I have not found anybody that knew, but I thought if you guys across the pond knew, that would be great.
There was a famous German singer at the time called Crazy Otto. There is someone called that. So I don't know if someone had got that in their old record collection. But there is a singer called Crazy Otto.
Well, we also, when you had lives stacked up at the bottom of the screen, we were calling those Ottomans, but.
That could have been it. Could have been.
No, I don't think that was it.
Let's put your feet
anyway. Up. Perhaps you could perhaps tell us how it went from, because Crazy Otto did actually get out into an arcade. Maybe you could pick up the story there.
Sure. No, I was very excited. I was going to get the answer, but oh well.
I know. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I feel bad.
So anyway, Crazy Otto was the name we had chosen. We, as you were saying, we're trying to make it as different from Pac-Man as possible to avoid some of the issues we had with Atari. So, I think at least we're trying to not have the name Pac in it, to not have the name Man in it. And we wanted the character to be distinguished from Pac-Man, so we gave him legs. And we did this, put it out on test at the arcade I mentioned earlier in Framingham, Massachusetts. And we had one out on test. And it turned out that while it was out on test, Time Magazine, one of the biggest magazines in the States, sent out writer and a photographer to write about the video game boom. And in it, they decided to talk about Pac-Man and take a picture of the game. And the one picture they got of the Pac-Man game that then went in Time Magazine talking about the video game boom was taken of the Crazy Otto, one of which existed in the United States out of over 100,000 games. They happened to choose that. And the writer did not notice that it was not Pac-Man, it was Crazy Otto.
Just bringing you back to Ms. Pac-Man, actually. How come you settled on the Miss and not the and not Mrs. or Miss, indeed?
Oh, that's what a long story. So when we created Crazy Auto, we created the three animation screens or interstitial screens between racks, so that when you clear a rack, you get a little cartoon as during your break. Similar to what Pac-Man did.
Yeah.
What we did on the Crazy Auto is the first act of that was Pac-Man, or in this case, originally Crazy Auto, the yellow character with legs, meeting a red character with legs. And it was entitled They Meet. And the two would come onto the screen and bump into each other. And then in the second act, the red Auto and the yellow Auto would chase each other around the screen, entitled They Chase. And then the third one has the two coming out, heart going above their head, and then a stork coming out above them and dropping a little baby Auto at their footsteps. And that animation was entitled Junior. And we had put that in, you know, having some fun with just doing a little cartoon and whatever. And somewhere along the way, someone said, hey, you have a yellow Pac-Man with legs and you have a red, I guess, female Pac-Man with legs. Why don't we make your sequel game a female Pac-Man?
Yeah.
And this had come after Midway had decided that they wanted to make the game, and the name Super Pac-Man was kicked around.
Yeah.
The name there was a Super Pac-Man and another Pac-Man, and then someone realized this female introduction in the screens and said, why don't we make the game female?
Sure.
And at this point, it got called Pac-Woman.
Right. Yeah.
And we created a character where it was a Pac-Man with very long red hair that you could see from behind. It was almost pure red hair. If you saw it from the side, it had this flowing shoulder-length hair. And
sounds a little creepy, Doug, actually, to be honest
with you. It wasn't the best looking. Trying to do things in the 14 pixels across you yes. have is difficult. Yeah. And we gave it red lips and whatever. You only had three colors to work with, so creating a good-looking female Pac-Man was not easy. It wasn't just a yellow disc anymore. But we sent that off, and it was Pac-Woman. And Bally Midway then sent it off to Japan to get approval from Namco. Mm. And I believe it was Nakamura who looked at it and goes, no. And it was not no to the sequel or anything. It was no to the red hair. He did not like it at all. So came back to the drawing board. In the meantime, someone had thought that Pac-Woman did not sound all that good. So while we created a new one with now, a bow in her, on her head, a beauty mark and red lips, the name got changed to Miss, M-I-S-S, Pac-Man. And we changed the three animations to be the exact same thing, but now it was Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man, running around in them. And it almost went into production that way. Until someone looked at it and said, look at that third animation where they have Junior. You're having Pac-Man and Miss Pac-Man have a baby. And this is back.
Out of wedlock.
You would not have a baby out of wedlock. So this was awful. And it quickly got changed to Mrs. Pac-Man, M-R-S, period. And then one of the engineers' wives, Eileen Malarkey, married to Mike Horowitz, said, hey, Mrs. is so dated. It's Ms. now.
Right.
And so it became Ms. Pac-Man. And so I guess we went through seven or eight names before it actually was settled on Ms. Backman.
So pleasing both the traditional and the progressive.
Absolutely.
Factions. Yeah, yeah, I like it. And we all know, obviously, that the game was hugely successful. So, I mean, just to tie up my section here, Doug, give us an idea of just how rich you all got, including GCC.
Well, we don't actually talk dollar figures, but...
That means it was a lot.
It was a lot.
sure.
That Ms. Pac-Man outsold Pac-Man in the Western Hemisphere. It was never actually sold outside the Western Hemisphere that I know of. But it did extremely well in the States. Timing was perfect. As people were getting tired of Pac-Man, out came Ms. Pac-Man. But not so far after that they had forgotten about it and forgotten how much they loved it. It was perfect in terms of, you know, them remembering all the things they liked. We even got credited with appealing to females because we had designed it for females, which was not true.
Well, yeah.
But sure, by the time it had a female name and a female character, it brought in more women playing the games, and it was outrageously successful. Well over 100,000 games, and it ended up making a lot of money for General Computer, for the engineers that worked on it that we shared the money with, for Bally Namco, or sorry, Bally Midway in the United States that thought they were going to have no product for 1982, and a lot of money going back to Namco. They ended up getting the same amount they were getting per Pac-Man machine for Ms. Pac-Man because that's the way their contract was written, that it was viewed as a derivative work and they would get the same royalty. So everybody did well, and fortunately there was lots of money to go around.
Well, Doug, by the middle of 1982, GCC seems to have been in a really envious position. Loads of money for Ms. Pac-Man, as you've just alluded to, plus this regular $50,000 a month from the Atari contract. I mean, did you just feel the coin-op world was at your feet?
I think we never actually stopped long enough to breathe and think about it.
Yeah.
We were trying to get Ms. Pac-Man out the door. We had just signed up with Atari and we're hiring engineers as quickly as we could because we felt this obligation of designing games for them because that's what we had signed for. Not that we had any amount of games we were supposed to deliver. And then, you know, the ability to grow was just so easy because we located ourselves right near the MIT campus. Recruiting was so much fun. You bring people in for an interview. You would let them play games while they waited. There are video games all over the place. And then if they were good enough, you'd make an offer probably higher than they were getting at other places. They could play games all day, get to write games, and they could even walk to work because we had located ourselves right outside the MIT campus. So
it seems like a fairly easy sell you got there.
So we became the biggest recruiter at MIT in 1982, passing HP and Intel and IBM, who were generally the big recruiters on campus. We came in and grabbed everybody that was good.
I mean, if this is 1982, obviously you've been at MIT perhaps only the year before. Were some people coming to interview going, hang on, I know you. Didn't you used to run the pinball machines in my dorm? Were people going?
Oh, even better yet, anybody we knew we were calling. So,
right. Brilliant. I've realised we've overlooked something here, is that you've gone through all this. When did you leave MIT?
Never.
Do tell.
So I told you before, I was working on two bachelor's and a master's degree. And I had completed all the coursework for them, but I had to write a combined thesis. And that was to be done in the spring of 1981. And if you check your timeline, that was when we were working on first Super Missile Attack, and then later Crazy Auto, which became Ms. Pac-Man. So I tell people, instead of my thesis, I wrote Ms. Pac-Man.
So that means you never actually graduated. Sorry to point that out.
No, Kevin and I both are college dropouts and view it with honor.
Yes, don't graduate now. It would. By the way, did they ever give you like an honorary degree? They do that in this country. Did MIT ever give you an honorary degree or no?
MIT has never given out an honorary degree in their history. I think every other university in the United States has. But we went to one that does not.
Okay.
I did later pick up an honorary high school degree, but that's not quite the same.
That'll do. Okay, so you've expanded, you've recruited lots of people. Can I ask you what might be a difficult question because it involves hindsight? But you just said you were the biggest recruiter of that year, you know, more than some of the really big, well-established companies. You know, in retrospect, do you think you expanded perhaps too quickly?
Oh, not at all. That we were working on projects which did not need great, really strong management structure. People knew what a video game was, knew how to try writing them, and we had the financing to do it. So we were just grabbing the best talent we could and growing the company quickly, and it was all working out very well.
Spot on. Now, you know this podcast is particularly interested in arcade games. So I'm going to ask you about the two original titles that were completed and released through Atari. And one was Quantum, which used a vector display, a trackball. It was quite an abstract concept of kind of capturing subatomic particles. And then the other one was Food Fight, which was like a high-speed twin-stick shooter with a kind of comedy theme on a raster monitor. So what I want to ask is, were you very keen not to put all your eggs in the same basket? Because those two projects seem very different.
So we allowed the engineers to just create. And this is the area I don't think we were particularly skilled at, a methodology of how do you create a video game. If it became, how do you do an enhancement kit for one, that was relatively well defined to us. If you had to do a home cartridge on a pre-existing game, that was pretty well defined to us. But to do an original work, was something that we decided, you know, at top management level, you know, we have no better expertise than any of the other engineers. So we said, you come up with an idea, describe it to us a little bit, and we'll let you go. And we'll give you a couple of hardware people, some artists and musicians, and you create it. And so we had a whole bunch of crazy ideas, but I think that's how the good ones get created.
I like that. Let's pick up one of the good ones, which is Quantum, which was the lead program on that was Betty Ryan. She was new to game design. Did you give her much direction when it came to Quantum, or did you let her find her own way?
Oh, she totally found her own way. She had come up with the idea that she wanted something that was not shooting. And that felt like a common theme of many of the games we did. Yeah. Even Food Fight, you're not shooting, you're throwing things in a comical way. Yeah. But with the exception of Super Missile Attack, which was not our initial game, being Missile Command, we did not do much in the way of shooting. And I don't know why we avoided that, or I guess we viewed that back then shooting games were different from what we thought they should be. And nowadays, there's so many shooting games. But anyway, Betty looked at it and said she wanted to do something totally different, not something that you're working tons of buttons doing, but instead very much centered on the, you know, beautiful motion of a trackball.
Yeah.
And so she first proposed that she wanted to take the trackball and control drawing circles and shapes on the screen and play with that. And as she did, she goes, okay, let me try capturing things. And later the theme came out that it was somewhat related to quantum physics, and you're catching neutrons and electrons and pulsars and all kinds of other things. So the game developed out of that. But it was very much Betty looking and going, it's really fun to take a trackball and just draw on a vector screen, and started off the game development from that.
And it is one of the reasons it's interesting is that it is quite abstract. Were you at all worried that it was too abstract to do well in the arcade?
Probably a little bit. The people that were working for us all had college degrees at high technical schools, and second degrees and third degrees. Betty herself had her master's from Harvard. And so, you know, we might have been a little bit elite on that, but that's why we put games out to test and to play. And we modify them after we do some of the testing. So, my guess is some of the concepts might have been viewed as complex or not understandable and got smoothed out over time.
Well, let's move on to the other game that was released that year, Food Fight, which is very understandable because it's not abstract. It's throwing custard pie food. It's a food fight. We've had Jonathan Hurd on the show before, and he talks a lot about tweaking a game until it was fun. Fun was very much the guiding principle at GCC. So maybe you could tell us, maybe from your view, how that worked as manager. I mean, would you wander around going, what are you doing? Show me. Is it fun yet? Is that how it worked?
That has always been the most difficult thing to define for a video game, is when does it become fun? And, you know, you laughed when you said food fight, you throw custard, and just the concept of that started out fun.
Yeah.
When you first played it, when it was in development, it was not fun. It took a while to get it to be fun. And it is really, really difficult as you're going along and going, I'm not sure this will ever become fun. And, you know, we probably worked on 10 to 20 other arcade games that we started developing on. The concept might have sounded fun, or the concept might have needed work. And you go a third of the way into it and it's not fun yet. And you go, do you give it more life? How long do you go? It's not an easy concept to decide.
That's fascinating. Those two games are certainly a great and original. During this time, you did also work on Junior Pac-Man. And I'm interested in that because, first of all, I think you had quite a role in that. In fact, indeed, was it your idea to make Junior, you know, the offspring, the star of the game?
Well, making Junior the star, I think, was the obvious thing. I don't know if I came up with that or what, and it almost doesn't matter. That we are looking and saying, when it became Ms. Pac-Man, and then Ms. Pac-Man and Pac-Man together have a baby named Junior, that seemed like the obvious direction. It was created in Ms. Pac-Man, but we had to do the follow-on. It was not clear that the game would make it to market because we had no rights to bring it to market. We would have to get Bally Midway to once again agree on it, and to get Namco to once again agree on it. And we said, it's worth the chance anyway, so we started the development. Later on, we'll find out that we're developing Junior Pac-Man. In parallel, Bally Pinball Machine is developing Mr. and Mrs. Pinball, Mr. and Mrs. Pac-Man. There is a baby Pac-Man being developed. Yeah. There is a Professor Pac-Man being developed. So Bally's doing one, Midway's doing another, Namco's doing another, and we're doing one. And we need the approval out of both Bally Midway and out of Namco for it to potentially go to market. So we were doing this kind of on spec, but we felt we knew the game best and we could get it to market fastest. So we started work on it and said, you know, we're obviously taking the character that came out of the third animation and making a game out of it, but we did not want to change the game significantly again. No. You know, Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man did well because they were very similar games. People knew how to play them. They wanted to go on to the next one. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to create one that was just the next extension. As we kicked things around, I came up with the idea of, well, let's make the maze bigger than the screen.
Right.
Meaning that right. it yeah. will scroll. Yeah. And this was a little terrifying at first. I created a cardboard cutout of how it would all work and whatever. And then Tom Westberg wired up a prototype of it and we tried it and it did not work well at first. When you went off the screen, it would suddenly start scrolling, but then scroll too far and whatever. And it wasn't until we really played with exactly how much it should scroll when could we get it right that it felt fair, right. that it wasn't moving around too much on you, that you knew what was happening and walk that fine balance about, this is challenging, but fair.
I love you said you did a cardboard cutout. I could just imagine that you'd got a sort of square piece of card and we're just moving it along the maze. Is that what you did?
Yes, we even designed the maze on that.
That is proper hands-on stuff. Doug, I know that when you were working on Super Missile Attack and Ms. Pac-Man, you were kind of constrained because you were modifying the code that had already been written by someone else. With Junior Pac-Man, of course, you're doing your own code, aren't you? I mean, were you again modifying the code, or was this now you could do your own stuff?
We could do our own stuff. We were assuming that we would have to get permission from Bally Midway and Namco, so using any of that code would be fine. We understood the code quite well at this point, so we were able to make any changes we wanted, create any characters or whatever. So I think you'll notice the fruit is the same and things like that, or some of the fruit is the same.
Yeah. The big thing, of course, is the scrolling, the first in the franchise to have a scrolling maze, which again actually has been an idea that's been picked up in later versions. My question now, again, in retrospect, do you think that idea worked?
Somewhat. I still found the maze a little bit jarring when it starts scrolling on you. Both from just, trying to keep your balance in the game as you're playing, not physical balance, but just a feeling of where you are and whatever. But it also, for the first time, had the monsters be able to be in a place not visible.
Yes.
They are off screen. And to some people, that was viewed as a great challenge. When I played it, always said, that's a little bit unfair because I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
And so I always had some issues with that. Other people seem to like it.
I mean, at least you're trying something new. I think that's what's most impressive. You weren't just churning out the same. I always thought with that game that you ought to have had a radar in the top so you could see where the ghost stroke monsters were. But anyway, I wasn't around in 1982, was I? Now, I am a very lucky man because when I was preparing for this, you sent me a list. I said, was there any games, arcade games, that you began and didn't finish? You sent me a list of 10. Okay. So I'm not sure we can go through all 10, but I'm now going to bring up a few names of games that you started developing but at GCC, but then stopped. And I'm going to start with one that we know a little bit about, and that's Laser Rail.
Laser Rail was a fascinating one. Had watched Dragon Lair come out. And if you're familiar with Dragon Lair, it had a laser disc player inside of it. Yeah. And it would play a stretch of cartoon and wait or get to a point where you would then input your decision, in effect, go right, go left, or whatever. And it would then jump tracks in the cartoon to what it just did, whether you died or whatever. And it was fascinating to people because it was graphics that were far superior to any other computer graphic at the time that was playing in real time. But it also had huge drawbacks that as you were moving about, you kept on going, but I want to go left here. Well, left wasn't an option. You couldn't go off the rails is what we kept on saying. You had to follow the rails and every now and then there was a potential branch.
Yeah.
So in kind of kicking around you had to stay on the rails, we came out with the idea of Laser Rail, where it was a roller coaster game where picture a train track going on a roller coaster, and at various points there were Ys and merges and forks and whatever in the rail that you could then switch to other rails, go other places, but still take advantage of the Laserdisc. And that the Laserdisc was going to be graphics that were produced by a computer of a roller coaster with branches in it.
I think that sounds like a far more honest way to approach a Laserdisc game. It's like, look, you can make a choice here or here. Did it get very far? I mean, was it playable, Doug?
I don't think it ever got to a point of being playable because we never mastered the Laserdisc. So the lead person on this was Paul Moody, and he was not an engineer. He was an artist. So I think he drew out a lot of the sketches, how it would work and whatever. And we were just starting to play with, the laser discs. I don't know why this one did not go ahead. I've got two potential guesses. One is the laser discs turned out to be quite fragile machines.
Yes, I'm thinking that's a big reason.
And, in the arcades, they did not survive all that well. Dragon Lair was often broken, or if you were playing and someone bumped into the machine, you would jump to another track. So it might have been that we were getting word that laser discs really were not ready for arcade environments.
I think a lot of companies got burnt, didn't they? So maybe you got out just in time.
Yeah, the other possibility, and this was looking back in hindsight, is a game came out from Williams called Star Rider, which seemed very similar in the end.
Yeah, that's it. That makes total sense. Now I'm going to pick another one up because Mike Horowitz, which we know who had a big involvement with Ms. Pac-Man, was involved with Fireman. Can you recall this one?
Sure. This one was a game a la Donkey Kong, probably the best way to describe it, where firemen were going up and down ladders on a burning building, a large brick building. We had really good-looking graphics of flames popping out the windows, and before the flames pop out, watching glows starting behind the windows, telling you that this one's about to burst into flames and whatever. And I think we even had, babies and, adults and kids and whatever you had to go save, in certain windows. The fun factor never kicked in on this. The graphics were, good looking. You got to run around and put out fires and save babies, and all that. But it never really had this feeling of goals and fun other than just constantly trying to put out the fires and save the kids. And it never became fun, I think, is probably its downfall.
Well, there you go. And you, I'm down to ask about a few more of these. One, again, by Keith Sawyer, called Magician. So what was that about?
I have no idea. All I can remember is in the center of the screen, a gigantic black hat and a rabbit. But okay. I don't recall what the game was about.
That's it. So, yeah, he never pulled the rabbit out of the hat with that one. I'm loving this. So I've not quite finished yet because there's another one with the rabbit theme. And it's quite brilliantly called White Rabbit or possibly Rabbitron. Tell us more.
Okay, so this game, as best as I can recall, was partly a creation by Tom Westberg, who was both hardware and software engineer, but he was often a lead hardware engineer on projects. And his favorite game was Robotron, and hence why Rabbitron was one of its nicknames. And he always wanted to design hardware that could support as many sprites as possible or stamps on the screen. And he kind of pushed us on, when we designed the 7800 home console, to be able to support the 96 stamps or objects that Robotron did. And so he was always pushing for more and more things on the screen. Now, I don't know if it then turned into kind of a joke of saying, well, if you're going to have a lot of things on the screen, we need rabbits reproducing.
Yeah, breeding like rabbits. Fantastic.
But from what I remember, the screen had lots of rabbits running around, and you controlled one of them that had spinning ears that allowed it to get up in the air. And they were trying out an encoder wheel for controlling the spinning ears and other different controls. And the name then, the nickname was Rabbitron. The name of the game in development was White Rabbit. And I think that, besides coming from all the rabbits running around, came from the Jefferson Airplane game, or song, White Rabbit, which talks about Alice in Wonderland.
Of course.
And if you remember, the first verse of that starts off, one pill makes you larger and another one makes you small.
You can mess around a lot with that and in game so mechanics, can't
you? You can imagine it. Dots that would make the rabbit become bigger and smaller, and caterpillars running around smoking hookah pipes. And
well, this is already sounding... we want all of these to be made. Let me just ask you a couple more. I'm just fascinated with all these. Is that some of them you can guess what they might be, but other ones you can't. So there's another one by Keith Sawyer, and it's just called Neon, which sounds like it's a sort of concept as opposed
to... No idea.
Right. Thanks, Keith, on that one. What about Roland Janberg's Rock Slide? Now, that sounds a little bit more guessable, maybe.
That was an Avalanche game, and I don't recall exactly its mechanics. I do remember Roland's other one called Nightmare.
Oh, which got a lot further on, I think.
Yeah, in fact, I was out in California once at a arcade show, and someone had the only known working copy of Nightmare from when it was out on test. And I talked to Roland about it, and he goes, no idea what happened to the test copy when we eventually moved out of video games. It was probably left at some arcade, and someone picked it up and kept it running. And so I played it out in California back in the late 90s, I think, and it was still running.
Isn't it amazing how these things just get out there and have a life of their own?
Yeah.
That's amazing. One on the list I've got to ask, because it's called Crystal Castle. Singular. Well, obviously, you don't have to be a genius to work out Atari was working on the game Crystal Castles, but this must have been about at the same time. Was your Crystal Castle at all connected with the one that Franz Lanzinger worked on?
Absolutely not. And okay. I remember hearing about their Crystal Castles, and we were really upset. We thought they had stolen the name from us, and they probably thought we stole the name from them. So who knows? This was a first-person maze game, and I believe it was on Vector hardware and had a lit-up crystal trackball as you moved around. And the concept sounded really fun, running around a maze in the first person, and it was not. when you tried running around, you get lost. You had no idea where you're going. And, you know, if you spent all the time just trying to figure out where you are, you couldn't then, you know, also take in all the gameplay and whatever. So I remember, then arrows going onto walls and other things trying to lead you in the right direction. And then, as you said, earlier when we were talking about Junior Pac-Man, we put an overview screen of where it was, of where you were in the maze. And then people just kind of played it on the overview screen, like Pac-Man. Go, okay, I can move around the maze now. And they ignored the first person.
All the effort you'd made on the 3D. Come to say, the fact that you just said play as it, that sounds like it was playable as well. That sounded like it got quite far along.
I don't think that went out on test. I think we kept on saying it was never fun enough in the lab to go out. it really sounded like it was going to be when we were saying, oh, first person running around a maze. Yeah, this is going to be really neat. Right. It just doesn't work.
If you'd only given them a gun. If only you'd given the gun, you could have invented Doom.
Oh, who knows?
9 years before. Yeah, so that was it. It's just bizarre that you came up with the same name. I mean, Crystal Castle. Was that just in the air? Is it just the alliteration? I wonder, any thoughts on why you got the same name?
It may have been alliteration, or it may have been out of sci-fi or something. I don't recall where it came from.
Okay. Now,
there's a bit of alliteration. So Food Fight, Crystal Castle, and I believe Quantum was originally called Molecular Madness. So there was kind of like a common theme going through.
Actually, Molecular Magic, I believe, but yes.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yes. Closer. So there's, yeah, anyway, sorry, just a small aside.
Can I say, I found that fascinating. We love hearing stories about things that didn't quite make it. Of all those games, which one, Doug, do you wish had actually made it?
I particularly liked Nightmare, and it almost made it. The Road Warrior game we were working on was also very good. It ended up, I think, in trouble more about its IP, and part of it didn't work all that well. We called it Road Warrior, but it was a Mad Max implementation. And Warner Communications, which owned Atari, also owned Warner Brothers Pictures, which owned Mad Max. And we had hoped that we could get this as a Mad Max license. And it never really worked out. It could not be pulled off through the studios and whatever. It got repurposed as a game called Motocross, where it was a very early driving game, kind of second person with a lot of hills and not a lot of curves. We had problems doing curves, but hills were a lot of fun. And we could get you to, you know, kind of lose your stomach as you went over a hill and into the air.
Kind of roller coaster feel.
That experience was fun. The gameplay never quite worked.
Can I say credit to GCC, who, you know, you were trying a hell of a lot of different ideas, genres, technology, and of course not all of them stuck, but kudos for you trying all that. That was great. Now, as you know, this podcast is focused on arcade games, and then quite abruptly in 1983, you leave producing arcade games behind and you switch to producing console games, initially for the Atari 2600. Doug, why?
Well, we never actually left doing the arcade games, but we started doing the consoles in addition. And this was at a request by Atari saying, hey, can you do a game for the 2600? And it was kind of just asked out of left field. And us naive MIT engineers, of course, said, absolutely.
Right.
And we had no idea what the 2600 did, what its limitations were, how it worked or anything. But of course we could do it. And what we did not know at the time is we were being asked because Activision and iMagic had pretty much just started up. And they were started up by ex-Atari engineers.
Of course.
And were heavily recruiting the Atari engineers out of California to come work for them. And Atari's home division had pretty much, home game division, had pretty much lost a lot of their engineers and a lot of their throughput. And this was happening at the time that the games were booming. And so they needed more engineers to work on them and asked us. And we said, sure, we'll give it a try. And this ended up being one of our specialties that, as you saw, and, you know, we probably batted similar to what a lot of games developers do in arcade games, you know, getting 2 out of 10 or 3 out of 15 or whatever it is. You know, where your average is not great, you have a lot of failures to get some good ones.
Yeah.
In the home conversions, it is more of a strict engineering project.
Yes.
You're not doing a lot of creativeness in terms of thoughts and designs. You're getting very creative on engineering and how to make a arcade game fit into a really simplistic home system. And this was really the expertise for a lot of the engineers of saying, all right, let's study the hardware and figure out how to get the most out of it. Let's play different things in software. Mm-hmm. Let's really get creative on crunching code. And we became very, very skilled at creating the home versions of a lot of the arcade games that were being created by Atari and by many companies in Japan.
I think just perhaps as a coda to this is that you GCC as a whole did a great job in squeezing some big coin ops into these tiny underpowered console that was invented in the 70s. But I think you're particularly proud because weren't you involved with converting Ms. Pac-Man? Didn't you do a version of that for the 2600?
Yeah, and that was our biggest challenge is Ms. Pac-Man was our game and we wanted to do it right.
Of course.
And in addition, at the 2600 Pac-Man had come out and it had flopped. It had been done on a very, very tight time frame, quite unfair to the programmer. It had been done in half the code space as Ms. Pac-Man had been done. ROMs got bigger in the meantime. And we took several engineers and threw it at it and say, this matters most to us. So I believe four of us attacked Ms. Pac-Man and said, we're going to do this right. We got a little bit longer time frame. We got more code space to write, but we're going to divide this up and do an amazing job on it. And so we worked really hard on that, partly because we would get more royalties on Ms. Pac-Man than any other game on there, obviously, because it was our game. But we also attacked it in some of the ways that we attacked the enhancement kits. We looked at Pac-Man and said, what did not work on the 2600 Pac-Man? And I think there are two major things that were done that needed to be improved. The first was the joystick did not work properly in 2600 Pac-Man. The original Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man in the arcade was a gated four-position joystick, up, down, right, left. That's all you could do. The controller for the 2600 was an eight-position joystick. And the question was, if you pushed the joystick up or left, what did you mean? Mm. Did you mean to go left or did you mean to go up? And on the 2600 Pac-Man, the decision was made, if you went up or left, let's just say that means you wanted to go up. And if you went lower left, let's just say that means you want to go down. And in actuality, that's not true. If you go left and then go upper left, that means you want to go left and then you want to go up. If you go up and then upper left, it means you want to go up and then go left. So upper left has two different meanings depending on how you got there. And once we realized that, we implemented it where you have a tiny bit of state. You said, where'd you come from? And therefore, that's what it means.
Really intuitive thing to do, to think how a player would be playing.
And that made the joystick feel proper. It still was not as great as the four-position gated joystick that was on the arcade one, but it worked quite well. So the second thing that people complained about, and I mentioned it earlier, is the 2600 Pac-Man had ghosts.
The flickering, yes.
They were flickering. The home system only had two stamps, and they had allocated one stamp for Pac-Man and one stamp for the four monsters. So the monsters were only on for 25% of the time, and hence were called ghosts because they flickered so badly. We started when we were programming the 2600, and Atari started doing this also, did what was called racing the beam, or realizing that once you had drawn one stamp on the upper part of the screen, you could reload the graphics and draw it again on the bottom part of the screen and get more than two stamps on the screen by changing the code while the electron beam's going across the TV set.
Yeah.
And this got to a point where we took the five characters, the Ms. Pac-Man and the four monsters, and put them out that if there were only two on any given scan line, there'd be no flicker. If there were three, the three would share two stamps, and they would be on two-thirds of the time. And the only time you got really bad flicker is when you had five all on the same row, and that did not happen all that often. So we were able to greatly reduce the flicker by doing this, and this was also done in many other games, and you know, it was not unique to us. Atari started doing it in other games also, but it took a lot more crafty programming to get all the timing just right such that you could do that. But this is, you know, what we did well.
So, Doug, what happened with Atari? Did your agreement just come to an end, or did you guys decide to sort of strategically move on to other things?
Oh, boy. So in 1984, we had worked really hard on trying to help Atari with the new direction for Atari consumer, particularly. We had developed the brand new game system, the 7800, which, by the way, was significantly better than the Nintendo system that came out a year later. It got introduced at the Consumer Electronics Show in June of 84. The warehouse was full of them. We developed about 25 games and other things for it. And we're ready to have it all start shipping, and we're working on the second group of games to come out with it. At that point, unbeknownst to us, Warner Communications, Atari's management or owner, had looked at Atari. Atari had lost a large amount of money in the months prior to this, partly due to Pac-Man and ET cartridges that were coming back, and partly due to the fact that there was a huge amount of competition from other companies that were doing good ports at this time or good cartridges. Mm-hmm. And Warner Communications believed that the video game market was a fad. They had made a lot of money on it, but it was over and time to move on. So Warner Communications decided to sell the company to Jack Tramiel of originally Commodore. And Jack Tramiel bought it for almost $0 and moved it ahead, saying that he believed that the future was in home computers, and bought Atari to become the premier low-cost home computer company, and decided video games was not part of its future. So he pretty much shut down their video game division, and we flew out, talked with him, and he did not really understand who we were or whatever, but he was very, very clear. He said, there's not much money left in video games, and any money left in it is mine. So if you guys think you're going to develop games and get royalties from me, not going to happen. So we looked at it and said, time to move out of video games. We picked up the company, and we had just watched the Super Bowl commercial in 1984 of the Apple Macintosh being introduced, and moved the company from doing video games to doing products for the Apple Macintosh. And we quickly became the largest developer in terms of number of engineers being applied, third-party developer for the Apple Macintosh.
Wow. Interesting. And am I right in saying GCC has existed in some form up until relatively recently?
It has. When we developed the products for Macintosh, the area we later excelled in quite well was printers. And right. We became a large producer of different printers, particularly laser printers for the Apple Macintosh. And so that company existed up until maybe 5 or 10 years ago. I left it in 1993, taking about half the employees with me to start up a company in interactive television called Video Guide. And Video Guide later merged with Gemstar, which then bought TV Guide and became Gemstar TV Guide International. And I was right there until I retired.
There is an interesting footnote to this whole story. And I think I've got the date right. Around about 2002, Namco and Midway decided to release an arcade cabinet called Ms. Pac-Man 20-Year Reunion, which was an arcade title sporting two games, one being Ms. Pac-Man and the other being Galaga. Kevin Curran, I understand, spotted this game out in the wild. And you guys were able to refer back to your original agreement with Namco and Midway and go to arbitration. Can you kind of summarize that story for us?
Yeah. So both of us had pretty much totally left the video game industry, paid no attention to what was happening and whatever. And then in 2002, the 20th anniversary edition did come out that it started selling. And Kevin stopped at a rest stop along the highway and saw it at in their arcade game room there, and immediately called up Bally Midway and said, whoa, we're not getting any royalty reports or checks on this. And they go, who are you? And we quickly explained General Computer and that we had created Ms. Pac-Man, and they explained very nicely back to us, well, no, Ms. Pac-Man was made by Namco. And we go, no. And we quickly realize this 20 years later, there are no senior executives there anymore that were there back in the 80s. And, you know, they actually did not know who we were. And so we had to produce some of these old contracts. And they had issues with them at first. And then started talking that we might get some money thrown our way. And we're going, no, that's not what was described under the contract. Getting paid eventually on those became relatively straightforward because it was contract law. But what later occurred a few years after that was the fact that Ms. Pac-Man started showing up on things like cell phones. And back in 1982 and 1983, when we had written the Ms. Pac-Man contract, or the Crazy Auto contract, as the case may be, cell phones were not even imagined. And so exactly how they would be covered under the contract was a fascinating interpretation. We had a section called electronic distribution. We had a section of consumer electronics. We had a couple of other sections, but how it applied and whatever was quite difficult to interpret. So we ended up in a long drawn out arbitration case where we had to settle out where the rights were and what we should get paid on. And so it all eventually got settled, but this was digging back through records that were 25 years old, trying to figure out what was written down and what was intended and whether intentions mattered or whether just the words in the contract.
Amazing. So you guys were able to get a second bite at the Ms. Pac-Man cherry.
Yes. The one, since you guys particularly talk about coin-op or arcade, the one area we did lose in the arbitration, we won on most, was the definition of coin-op video games. We would get royalties based on the 1982-83 contracts based on the coin-op video games. And a company called Brookstones in the United States starts selling home arcade versions that would go into people's houses. It still cost like $2,000. Right. We claim those were identical to the ones that were going in the arcades, and at the time they were, and the arbiter said, yes, you are entitled to get a royalty on those because they're coin-operated, only to have the coin door replaced by a decal later on that said, you know, hey, we don't need the coin operation in there, because no one in the home actually drops coins in it. And hence, we don't want to pay for the mechanism anymore. And we don't want to pay your royalty anymore. It is no longer coin operated. And
right.
We got in difficult arguments about whether the coin operated nature was just describing the type of machine and not the fact it was physically operated by a coin going into the slot in the front of the machine. And that was the one the judge felt in their favor. So we did not get the ones that were made through Brookstones.
Okay. Interesting. And do you still own the rights to Miss Pac-Man, or has that since been sold on elsewhere? Or is that a whole other story?
It's a whole other story. So the rights were primarily assigned in the contracts going back to 82, 83, that were then arbitrated in 2002. And those contracts allowed them, Bally Midway and Namco, to produce the games, but defined how the royalties should get paid. We recently sold off the royalty stream rights to a Hong Kong manufacturer who had other issues he wanted to solve. And so he bought them. So that was our third bite at the apple.
Fascinating. Miss Pac-Man is clearly the game that just keeps on giving.
Yes, but it is now finally done for us.
Okay.
I like how it keeps giving you opportunities to do puns there, Tony.
Thank you.
Well done. I like that. And in fact, a bite of the apple was also relevant as well. So good punning, you lads.
Thank you very much. Doug, thank you so much for talking with us. This has been an absolutely fascinating conversation.
You're very welcome. This has been fun to talk about it. And sorry, my memory cannot pull up some of those old games. I'm going to have to look into them.
I think you're pretty good at it. Pretty good. What I wanted to say, which I found amazing. Thank you for sharing all those stories, Doug. But what I found amazing is that in 2002, no one knew, or certainly no one at Namco or Bally Midway, is that you would produce that game. And I would just like to think that all the in the 21st century, podcasts like this, magazines like Retro Gamer, you know, now everyone knows those stories. So I just think things have really changed. So thank you so much for sharing all of those. And by the way, I really like Pac-Woman. I wish it had been called Pac-Woman. It sounds kind of primeval, Doug. What do you think?
I don't recall what the problem was with that, but it quickly got changed.
Yeah, Doug, for my part, I'm just simply echoing what Tony and Paul said. Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you. And your memory is absolutely perfect from my point of view.
Thank you, Doug.
You've been listening to the Ted Dabney Experience Podcast with me, Richard May, Retro Gamer Magazine's Paul Drury, and arcade blogger Tony Temple. The show was produced and edited by myself, with a bespoke score and sound suite by Ghost of Wood.
I thought the crazy Otto bit really worked, Richie.
As I said on my message to you onto the group chat, I am such a doofus. Well,
I've not looked at that because I was talking to you, but I didn't. Fine. I thought that was quite good. You're like, oh, we know this one. And he goes, do we? And he went, what?
Yeah.
I kind of like that.
I'll leave it in au naturel.
And I don't just think kind of polish it across. As bad. It was only that you said, of course, some of our readers will have got listened to our podcast in depth. And it's like, obviously not you, mate.
Obviously not myself.
This is going well.